I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor garret studio by Bob Perlman, author most recently of a book of poems, If Life, published by Roof Books, whose early books, among them aka Braille and To the Reader, otherwise hard to find, are available in digital facsimile at Craig Dworkin's Eclipse site. And by Rachel Blau Duplessis, a critic and poet whose long poem Drafts has been published in installments, one of which, Torx, Drafts 58-76, was published by Salt Modern Poets, and whose Draft 85, just to take one example, called Hard Copy, is available as a sound recording in its entirety on Rachel's fabulous Penn Sound page. And by Charles Bernstein, who is author of 41 books. I used to say 40, but there's a 41st. Collections of poetry, essays, pamphlets, libretti, translations, and collaborations, whose volume of selected poems entitled All the Whiskey in Heaven is now available everywhere, absolutely everywhere, and who, with me, I'm honored to say, is co-founder and co-director of Penn Sound. Welcome back, all three of you, to Poem Talk. Charles, congratulations on the selected poems.
Thanks very much.
And hi, Bob. Rachel, welcome back.
Hi.
Well, today we've got a daunting task. We're going to talk for just 25 minutes about Charles Olson's major effort, The Maximus Poems, an impossibility. Just to make this a bit saner than it would otherwise be, we'll focus on one poem from this multi-decade sequence, namely Maximus to Gloucester, Letter 27, Withheld. And maybe such a close reading will give us a chance to comment a bit on the qualities of the project overall, or maybe not. Olson says withheld, presumably only because the poem was simply not included in the 1960 book, The Maximus Poems, which brought together parts of the epic project that had been in two earlier books published in the 1950s. And yet this poem, Letter 27, was one that was in much demand at the crucial Vancouver Poetry Conference in 1963 and elsewhere in the early to mid-60s. Penn Sound's Olson Page has a recording of his reading of the poem at Vancouver. A YouTube video has surfaced in which you can see and hear Olson read this poem in 1966. We've linked to that from Penn Sound. The version we're going to hear was performed at a reading in Boston in June 1962. So here now is Charles Olson intoning Maximus to Gloucester, Letter 27.
Maximus to Gloucester, Letter 27. I come back to the geography of it, the land falling off to the left, where my father shot his scabby golf, and the rest of us played baseball into the summer darkness until no flies could be seen, and we came home to our various piazzas where the women buzzed. To the left, the land fell to the city. To the right, it fell to the sea. I was so young, my first memory is of a tent spread to feed lobsters to Rexall conventioneers, and my father, a man for kicks, came out of the tent roaring with a bread knife in his teeth to take care of. A druggist, they'd told him, had made a pass at my mother, she laughing, so sure, as round as her face, Heinz pink and apple, under one of those frame hats women then wore. This is no bare incoming of novel abstract form. This is no welter or the forms of those events. This, Greeks, is the stopping of the battle. It is the imposing of all those antecedent predecessions, the precessions of me, the generation of those facts which are my words. It is coming from all that I no longer am, yet am, a slow westward motion of more than I am. There is no strict personal order for my inheritance. No Greek will be able to discriminate my body. An American is a complex of occasions, themselves a geometry of spatial nature. I have this sense that I am one with my skin. Plus this, that forever the geography leans in on me. I compel backwards, I compel Gloucester to yield, to change. Polis is this.
Why don't we start with the beginning? He says, I come back to the geography of it. Why? Come back implies that he's been straying from the point earlier, or he wants to get to the meat of something. And of course, it's an odd first line, since it suggests that we should have been reading some other things. Anybody want to take a stab at the diction of I come back to?
Returning again. Let us go back to this, which I've come to again and again through the course of the poem, the person speaking to some reader and invoking an address as in a conversation.
And has the hint of a corrective.
Yes, although not necessarily a corrective. I mean, he digresses, but I think it's also that it's a recurrence for him. I always want to come back to this.
And what really strikes what really strikes me about it is the fact that the zones of the rippling outward start with the personal and continue to recur to that personal moment, his zone, his father, his mother, the left and the right, which are on the YouTube, with major choreographic gestures, fabulous gestures, and then going outward, outward, outward from the body to the place, to the world history, and it's the zones are continuous. He has no question about the linkage of the zones. There's no impediment to doing that.
So when you say zones, you mean to imply this term, this big term, geography, don't you?
Like a geography, yeah.
There's also the further we go back, the further we go ahead. So when he says later, the predecessions, the procession. So by going back, we also go forward. And the poem has that rhythmic element of backward and forward.
Bob, what do you think it does in the first line? I come back to the geography of it. Is it the project, the poem? Is it Gloucester? Is it his personal history?
I think it's
all of those.
All of those. It's this is such a personal poem. Obviously, I can see why he withheld it and then gloried in it later once he accepted it, because it transgresses against so many Olsenisms. It's a poem about his parents. He's happy in his complete connection with those memories. I mean, I'm exaggerating this particular reading. I'm saying I come forward to the poetic blasphemy of this piece, because I do think that it's necessary to not just take Olson at his word.
I come back to the geography of it, the land falling off to the left, where my father shot his scabby golf, and the rest of us played baseball into the summer darkness until no flies could be seen, and we came home to our various piazzas where the women buzzed. To the left, the land fell to the city. To the right, it fell to the sea. I was so young, my first memory is of a tent spread to feed lobsters to Rexall conventioners, and my father, a man for kicks, came out of the tent roaring with a bread knife in his teeth to take care of a druggist they'd told him had made a pass at my mother, she laughing, so sure, as round as her face, Heinz pink and apple, under one of those frame hats women then wore.
Is there anything about that anecdote that could undercut its American nostalgic sweetness?
I think I want to say no.
I want to say yes. Can I say yes?
Sure,
and then
absolutely.
Let you react? Okay, yeah. A couple things. First, you know, the Maximus poem spends a lot of its energy arguing against American mercantilism, and it laments what happens to Gloucester in the modern era in an almost Poundian sense about the economy. But here we have this sweet memory, but in fact it's about druggist, pharmaceutical conventioneers. There's something distasteful about those guys. That's first. Second, you have this bad baseball pun of the flies are not buzzing flies at the end of the evening. They're, in fact, fly balls. but the women buzz. So there's a certain disharmony there that's a problem. And thirdly, and then I'll let you talk, Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a mock epic, a battle over a woman. There's a tent involved, a man with a knife. There's epic jealousy. It's all mock, of course. We have a mock epic in this pseudo contest with these conventioneering pharmacists. And so the Greekness of this, or the westwardness of this, it kind of falls flat in Gloucester when the Greek epic gets there. So I see all kinds of ways in which this anecdote could be ironized. Bob, take it away.
No, I very much, I think that's a great reading, all that you said. And it's a very sweet anecdote that displays and contains and miniaturizes paternal rage, so that we know it's mock rage, that there isn't really a knife between the teeth. But of course the rest of the poem very much goes off
and
from
does the Maximus thing,
and yeah. does the Maximus thing, and the punchline polis is this, that.
Not polis is I, but polis is this. What is this there?
Well, polis
is situatedness. This
is the power of I compelling Gloucester to yield. Polis is this. I mean, it's a really odd statement. I remember, as a kid being really wowed by this poem. Among other things, I think now I look at it and hear it in that, especially the YouTube reading.
How would you describe the voice in the YouTube reading?
Yeah. Well, it's incredibly charming. In fact, there's quite a contrast between this reading that we have and the YouTube reading. I think he reads it actually better on the YouTube, which is sort
Absolutely.
Of terrible to say in this context. First of all, he's so pleased with himself.
He is pleased.
It is an incredibly charming performance of one's own kind of modest charisma, where he is in gathering with gestures. The gestures are large, and they go in all directions, up, down, and it's like seeing somebody who is a Mediterranean person gesture with the hands. When he gets to polis is this, he is really self-presenting. It is him with both his hands
this
out.
Body.
This body, this zone, this person, this extension. It's all contained
these articulated
here.
Powers.
Yeah,
that this poem is.
Go ahead, Charles.
Without contradicting what you're saying, there is an explicit. Well, I'm saying not contrary, because I'm very sympathetic to the overall reading you're giving of Olson. Still, I've always liked the explicit other reading that he gives about the ego in this, which is that he is no longer what he, for all that I no longer am, yet am, the slow westward motion of more than I am. So he is suggesting that the I in that is the product of the resistance to the present, the understanding of what the future could be, of possibility, and also the recognition of the past. So, and it's the intersection of those things, which is the American. So it's not, he's explicitly rejecting the idea that it's about him in some just biographical sense.
I mean, that's right. That's quite right. Yeah, that's quite right.
But nonetheless, I'm saying again, it doesn't take away from what you are saying, Rachel, in terms of reading Maximus. In terms of his personality.
I am one with my skin in the most superficial contemporary American rhetorical sense is some crap about feeling good about yourself.
Easy in his
but
skin,
he's not, yes.
But it comes from Whitehead
that,
in this
he's
case.
Also talking, he's also talking grandly about the complexity of the American identity.
But even I am one with my skin is comes, you know, a lot of this poem is appropriated directly from Whitehead, and I think, though you're right to
Alfred
read that,
North
Alfred North Whitehead, and while you're right certainly to was an enormous influence on him, while you're right to read it that way, that's what's sort of interesting about what Bob is saying and Rachel, since these two views, the other aspect of that, which is the opposite of the idea of the lyric person, lyric poem expressing itself, is what I like to call the animality of the body, that the body is this animal thing that's connected to the geography, not some separate ego that's autonomous and that can speak.
There is no strict personal order for my inheritance. No Greek will be able to discriminate my body. An American is a complex of occasions, themselves a geometry of spatial nature. I have this sense that I am one with my skin. Plus this, that forever the geography leans in on me. I compel backwards, I compel Gloucester to yield, to change. Polis is this.
You know, the quotation from Whitehead is misquoted, and this is the interesting substitution. Whitehead apparently says the human body is a complex of occasions, etc. And Olson is quoting it as an American is a complex of occasions. This is not a small substitution.
Well, it changes the meaning entirely. Precisely. To what, would you say?
Well, what I was trying to say before was, although Olson has a feels a world historical mission around his ideas of geography and place and rootedness, nonetheless, there's a special soft spot in his heart for American exceptionalism, and there's a way, as we know, of reading the westward procession, the westward motion, as just a recast version of Manifest Destiny.
Oh, absolutely. And
I don't want to
yeah.
be too reductive.
No, I'm
interested in this issue of American exceptionalism in respect to what's being said, and also especially with you here, Al, because one thing, American exceptionalism means that we are somehow able to do things that other people haven't been able to do, or that we're exempted from some of the previous problems that other that Europeans have had. And yet, of course, Olson, I mean, the power of hearing Olson read, if you never have heard Olson read any of the versions, is that it's a remarkably oratorical style. It's like a politician at a convention in some way. But as to the American exceptionalism, the whole force of the poem is against aspects of the Cold War. I mean, Olson does stand in a very contradictory way, that he both exemplifies many of the problems that we may see in the 50s, but he also, at a very explicit level, and I, you know, of course, my earliest writing on Olson was mostly about those negative things, but, you know, I've had to learn the simplest things last. And the simplest thing here is that actually very strong counter-hegemonic force to this poem is very inspiring and very powerful. And it has to do with how we use the past, and that we are not beholding to the tradition. We are not, we have the past, our parents and so on, but that does not entirely define us. The generation of those facts is also the historical, the Greeks, the Western civilization. It's also the generations of a person. And that is what the words are. Our words come from that past, but that I no longer am, yet am, the slow westward motion of more than I am. So that's also like, of course, call me Ishmael, the West, the space going outward. That's partly the Western exceptions, but it's also the idea that responsibility is in what we do with the past, not being determined by it.
I wonder if I can switch it up a little and ask about the differences between the figure of Patterson in William Carlos Williams' Patterson and Maximus here, who I agree with Charles, contains all these contradictions, which are partly about American ascendancy after World War II. Patterson doesn't seem to have all the same problems, or does he?
I think that there's the thematic frame that Williams starts to deploy and thankfully
abandons.
Continually forgets about and abandons. But the frame itself is a very clunky man like a city, women like flowers, etc. I mean, it's...
Women like the land, the
mountain. So you know, in that...
to this discussion, does Patterson realize his inheritance? Does he claim his inheritance? I don't think so.
No, I think that...
Getting back to Olson, what do you think Olson is saying when he talks about my inheritance? And by the way, the line right after that is, no Greek will be able to discriminate my body. He's claiming...
I take this as a poetic, a move in a very self-conscious poetic history.
I think, you know, there's a lot of echo of Pound. You know, I cannot make it cohere and all the rest. I think he's actually embracing the anti-Poundian poetics, which I think is his great, you know, critique of Pound, that he is letting a certain complexity and contradiction be a part of the drift of the poem while still emphasizing a kind of idea of polis as a community, something beyond himself that can speak. Now, just by saying that, you don't do that. I keep going back to that. Yeah, I understand that problem. But
see, part of the problem for me is that there is, as with any, I imagine, long poem like this, But particularly Olson's and Pound's, rather than Patterson, which you can learn from as you go, there's a necessity to know some of the ideas, as if the poem is a gloss on, no pun on Gloucester, but a gloss on the ideas of the poet, which have been expressed in other places, in Pound's case, in his essays, in Olson's case, also in his essays, and to some degree in his seminars, let's say. So when he says, no Greek will be able to discriminate my body, that's my emphasis in the reading, an American, and so on. He actually has a whole complex of ideas about Greekness, and Greekness stands for abstraction and Western civilization and the ideas of abstraction, et cetera. In other words, it's a whole philosophical argument. But the thing is that you have to know all that stuff about Greeks to put it in, so that it really does depend on other features of his statements.
By the way, Pound says go in fear of abstractions, and the whole about ideograms in ABC of Reading is anti-abstraction.
First of all, it's a sequence. It even has a number. There are other things that are earlier. And two clear things is that it's Heraclitus that he's saying we need to go back to some archaic sense. That's what going back beyond what we thought was our inheritance to move forward beyond where we are. There's, of course, the bomb and the extermination process should always say, I cannot read poem from this period by Olson without understanding. 1950, he's reflecting on, what Spicer calls the human crisis. And earlier in the poem, he's very clear that he's saying that we're suffering from, rule by the worst, and that we have to combat that rule by the worst. So, and the polis is the way that we combat it. That's all background.
But by the end of the poem, it's foreground. We combat it by compelling ourselves backwards.
That's right.
So that, as a final question before we go around and get last words here in this conversation, just to be as superficial as possible, I see the poetics tending toward what might be called conservatism, or the feeling not that I compel backwards so that Gloucester can yield and change, but I compel backwards so that it can resist change. It seems to me that the concept of change by the end of the poem is potentially plainly nostalgic. The kind of changes that you see in the local society will undermine his dream of polis. And so I wonder if anybody feels similarly, that there is compelling backwards is regressive.
Well, you're saying it's nostalgic, so you're using nostalgic. The other. There's the two senses of nostalgia. There's the Greek sense, which is the one he wants, and there's the inevitable reading, which Bob and
well, there's
Jim
the
said,
first personal memory sense nostalgia. Of nostalgia as well that's operating in this poem. Anybody want to take the bait on that?
I'll sort of bite at a slightly different part of the poem, very close to what you're looking at. Can it be said that the polis at the end is a very lonely polis, since it's I compel Gloucester to yield? And there, we don't have to call it nostalgia, but maybe utopianism at the very end. Polis is this. There's the deixis of this. Somehow it's the happiest of endings. This word, this poem, this gesture is polis. It is achieved now as I write and speak the word this, and such thises always slip back into the sort of ironic midden of all the other thises and other words that people use.
Actually, that's really sort of fascinating, because it is proclaimed by the gesture at the end of his YouTube reading. I just call attention to the rhyme polis and this.
Mm. Yeah, polis is YouTube, these days.
We could go on for pretty much ever. So what I want to do is invite you each to add some final observation, something that you weren't able to get into the conversation. And I would invite Rachel maybe to opt for explaining why she came into this discussion pretty excited about maybe a new view of Olson. Do you want to try that or skip it?
A new view of Olson.
Yeah, you got kind of excited.
My special view of Olson.
Well, the fact is that I had never seen the performance, and I had never seen Olson in person for a variety of accidents. I could have, but didn't. And I was fascinated by the charisma. That would be my answer. We have not talked about gender. I will reserve judgment. I will just say that what fascinates me is the letter as genre, as the importance of the epistolary, both in terms of his contacts with people like Francis Bolduref and Creeley at that point, where he's writing letters, and those are clearly takeoff zones for writing this poem mainly as letters, and just the importance of the constant readdress of a figure to his community that is central to this poem.
Great. Thank you for adding that. Bob, final word or non-final word?
Let me wait to Charles.
Okay, Charles. Bob is thinking.
There is no strict...
And it's a marvelous thing to see when Bob is thinking.
It happens sometimes.
Yeah. I'm thrilled by the stanza, "There is no strict personal order for my inheritance," in terms of the reflection on history and what it is to consider what history is. Both that it's not a personal order and that there's nothing strict. And I think that immediately goes in also to the claim that an American is a complex of occasions, themselves a geometry of spatial nature. This is what we need in 2010 to remember, especially against these kind of new fundamentalisms about American identity. This is a radical attack and critique on the idea that America is one thing and that there's some essence to it. And in that sense, in answer to your earlier question, Al, the angel of history in Walter Benjamin moving backward from the disaster is evoked. Backwards I compel. Into the angel of history moving backward from the disaster. Backwards I compel Gloucester to yield, to change. Polis is this dynamic, this method of thinking, this invoking of others in dialogue.
Thank you. Bob?
Okay. I'd love to desacralize our heroes. Olson is a heroic figure. The sacralization always is a problem and a lessening as opposed to a lesson. So I just think that's one of the things I always find myself feeling like doing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, or maybe all three of us, to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And if you can each be brief, then we can get all three in. Bob.
The reading last night by Laura Elrick, her as yet unnamed piece. This would be March 3rd, 2010, Kelly Writer's House. Terrific.
Okay, and of course that's available as a recording. It will be available on Penn Sound. Charles?
Well, let me mention another Penn Sound feature. I've just put up a couple of new close listening shows, so we've now passed the 100 mark of readings and conversations.
Fantastic.
With contemporary poets.
And I have to say that the new one of the new programs, the Fred Waugh program, is just stunning and wonderful.
I'm teaching a course on the prose poem and trying to define it, which is impossible. But recently, because of a student intervention, we read Jacques Roubaud, Something Black, which is translated by Rosemary Waldrop. And I have to say, it really bears a lot of scrutiny.
Thank you. Well, that's all the generation of facts we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Charles Bernstein, Bob Perlman, and Rachel Blau Duplessis, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.